It is my great honor to introduce one whom we welcome as not only one of the greatest living Americans of this age, but one of the truly great Americans of all time, soldier, statesman, and patriot, General of the Army, Douglas MacArthur.
Grand entrances made before at Republican National Conventions, but never one quite like this. Temporary Chairman Walter Hallinan made his speech of introduction to General of the Army Douglas MacArthur, who obviously was waiting during the speech just underneath the bandstand out of sight. And as the last words were spoken, on came a great platoon of Chicago police holding their night sticks, their billies, as if they were little guns. And they're having a big argument now. The police themselves have advanced down the center aisle all the way to the front of the rostrum. They're followed closely by General MacArthur wearing a dark blue suit, white shirt, dark tie. Can't tell whether it's blue or black from here. There's Senator Nolan of California caught in the crush. It's the photographers who are making the crush, those industrious gentlemen who get the pictures you'll see in your newspapers tomorrow. The committee is caught between two layers of Chicago police. One group that preceded the general and the committee, and the other group that came right behind. They're stretched halfway down the center aisle now. Every person in the convention hall seems to be on his feet. And now General MacArthur has come to the rostrum. The crowd has seen him. He is shaking hands with Chairman Hallinan and will listen to the roar. Waving rolled up newspapers, the ladies waving a handkerchief enthusiastically as General of the Army Douglas MacArthur in the dark blue shirt suit stands there on the rostrum as his right hand on the speaker's desk turns to say a few words to Chairman Hallinan, who stands on his left. Herbert Hoover, former President of the United States, made a couple of grand entrances to Republican National Convention, but none so dramatic, none so carefully worked out, thought out, and planned as this one has been. Somewhere down there in the party that rushed down with the police, who CBS reported Jesse's house, and I don't know how he got mixed up with the party, but he did indeed. A squad of police leading the way, then the committee with General MacArthur and a squad of police bringing up the rear, and those police are stretched all the way down the center aisle, halfway to the rear of the hall. You can imagine how the flash bulbs are twinkling. Imagine how the flash bulbs are crackling. Delegates standing up on their chairs shouting to the general, shouting words of encouragement and advice and greetings. The flag of Texas is waving rigorously back and forth. Many of the state standards lifted from their sockets and being waved. Arkansas, Nebraska, Georgia, Texas too, waving back and forth. And here he addresses the convention.
Fellow Americans, I now present with great pride the keynoter of the Republican National Convention of 1952, General Douglas MacArthur.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, possibly never before has a soldier been called to a rostrum such as this to participate in the deliberations of a great political party. I approach the task in a spirit of humility, born of full understanding of my own marked limitations, but fortified by so solemn an obligation. In this unusual assignment, I feel a deep consciousness of the nature and gravity of the crusade upon which we now embark. A crusade to which all sound and patriotic Americans, irrespective of party, may well dedicate their hearts and minds and fullest effort. Only thus can our beloved country restore its spiritual and temporal strength and regain once again the universal respect. I speak with a sense of pride that all of my long life I have been a member of the Republican Party. As before me was my father, an ardent supporter of Abraham Lincoln. I have an abiding faith that this party, if it remains true to its great traditions, can provide the country with a leadership which, as in the days of Lincoln, will bring us back to peace and tranquility. Perhaps it is unnecessary here to indict the present administration for all of its tragic blunders, for that indictment has already found full expression in the resentments which have poured from the hearts of the American people from north to south, east to west, with no distinction of race, creed, color, or political affiliation. I know from the four corners of the land, I have seen, I have heard. It has been a spontaneous expression, reflecting a deep sense of fear that our leaders, in their insatiate demand for ever more personal power, might destroy the Republic and erase from the earth those mighty principles of government which brought to this land a liberty, a dignity, and a prosperity never before known. It has been an expression of faith in our ultimate destiny as a free people, an acknowledgement of individual responsibility in the achievement of that destiny, a vibrant testimonial that the love of liberty still burns unquenchable in the American heart. Many of the people who thus register the depth of their resentments do not fully comprehend the nature and degree of the policy misdirection which has brought us to fiscal instability, political insecurity, and military weakness. But they view with dismay the failures of our leaders in the short aftermath of victory, which causes us, the once proud and mighty victor, unceasingly to call upon every American mother to yield her sons in a fight for national survival, which causes us to submit to extortion and blackmail for the release of our citizens unlawfully detained by nations with which we are at peace, which causes us to deprive our beloved divisions committed to battle in Korea of the power and the means and the will to achieve victory, our country's traditional military goal. They view with dismay the alarming change in the balance of world power arising from the tragic decisions taken by willful or guileless men representing us at Tehran, Yalta, Potsdam, and elsewhere. Those reckless men who, yielding to international intrigue, set the stage for Soviet ascendancy as a world power and our own relative decline. They view with dismay the tragic weakness of our leaders, reflected in their inability to rebuild our strength and restore our prestige even after our commitment to war in Korea more than two long years ago dramatically emphasized the inadequacy of our security preparations, reflected in their inability to conserve our resources even while they warn of national peril, reflected in their tolerance of corruption, or worse, in the higher positions of the public service. They view with dismay the rising burden of our fiscal commitments, the deprivation of the opportunity to accumulate resources for future security and family obligations, the growing tendency of government to control personal life and suppress individual freedom. Our people are desperate for a plan which will revive hope and restore faith as they feel the oppressive burden of the tax levy upon every source of revenue and upon every property transaction. As they see the astronomically rising public debt heavily mortgaging the industry, the well-being, and the opportunity of our children and our children's children. As they observe the rising costs of the necessities of life impairing the effectiveness of pensions, insurance, and other fixed incomes, and reducing the aged and infirm to appalling circumstances. They look to their leaders, but their protests are silenced by the grim warnings of the disaster of a possible total war. They see no sign of concern, hear no words of encouragement, find no basis for easing fear. Their every expression of hope for reduction in the tax burden is met by the angry rejoinder that taxes must go ever higher. There is no plan to transform extravagance into frugality, no desire to regain economic and fiscal stability, no prospect of return to the rugged idealism and collective tranquility of our fathers. They yearn to regain the religious faith and spiritual rectitude of the past. They remember the counsel of General Washington when he said in his farewell address, "Of all the dispositions and habits which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports." In vain would that In vain would that man claim the tribute of patriotism who should labor to subvert these great pillars of human happiness, these firmest props of the duties of men and citizens. But the people detect no heed given this wise counsel. They witness instead only a ceaseless effort to spend and spend, to tax and tax, only a callous indifference to mounting disclosures of graft and corruption and waste in the public administration. The religious devotion of the American people, which has produced the universally reflected spirituality of the American home, has been outraged by the materialism and selfishness which dominates the national administration. Public policy
no longer is geared to the simple determination of that which is right and that which is wrong. The objective has been to build political strength even at the expense of the public interest. This is incomprehensible to our people, who understand fully the influence religion and morality have always exerted upon political stability. They know from the lessons of history that national strength and greatness inevitably find their true measure in existing moral and ethical standards. But one asks, how can it be that the party of Jefferson and Jackson, which once contributed so magnificently to the building of the Republic, would now sponsor and support so tragic a cleavage from our great tradition? How could it despoil these very concepts of humanity and government upon which rested our past spiritual and temporal strength? The answer is as clear as it is distressing. That party of noble heritage has become captive to the schemers and planners who have infiltrated its ranks of leadership to set the national course unerringly. To set the national course unerringly toward the socialistic regimentation of a totalitarian state. To such end, they have sought to circumvent the safeguards to our liberties wisely written into the Constitution of the United States. At one stage, there was even the attempt to subvert the independence of our Supreme Court by adding new members pliable to the will of the executive. At another, the claim of extraordinary inherent power without the slightest sanction in law. They have too frequently regarded that immutable charter as an instrument of political expediency. In the hypocrisy of self-righteousness, they hail their course as true liberalism. Yet every move they make to circumvent the spirit of the Constitution, every move they make to centralize political power, every move they make to curtail and suppress individual liberty is reaction in its most extreme form. For the framers of the Constitution were the most liberal thinkers of all the ages, and the charter they produced out of the liberal revolution of their time has never been and is not now surpassed in liberal thought. Our forefathers associated together into a sovereign state for the sole and only purpose of protecting their common liberties, not of yielding them again to a centralized federal authority. Their concept held to the primacy of the individual's interest, that of our present leadership, to the predominance of the state. They who trample upon constitutional liberty by the undue centralization and imposition of political power are turning back the pages of history and gradually reinstituting those very excesses and abuses for which the British Crown was indicted in 1776 by our Declaration of Independence. They are the dangerous reactionaries in contemporary American politics. They have trifled with that great American institution, free, private, competitive enterprise. Keystone to the arch of our economic strength as a nation and prosperity as a people. By the imposition of oppressive and arbitrary controls upon business and production, by exhaustive taxation, which withers initiative, reduces energy, and in the end destroys the spirit of enterprise, by spendthrift policies which stagger the imagination, by discouraging adherence to the principle of private ownership of property, they have established the prerequisites to a socialistic or even later a communistic state. And as they thus chart a course with such reckless abandon leading toward ultimate national bankruptcy, they endeavor to mislead and control the public mind by a patronage of money, by devices calculated to create an artificial appearance of prosperity, and by a continuous flow of irresponsible and deceptive propaganda. But the people, in their innate wisdom, are not misled by such tactics of deception. Alert to reality, they know that the value of the dollar has diminished about 50% and is still going down. They find insufficient compensation in nominally higher income, however skillfully propagandized as a mark of prosperity. They entertain a growing fear that the same policy misdirection which has debased the dollar will in time so impair our economy as to imperil the nation's solvency and thus destroy our living standards. With the dollar down, prices up, and taxes increased, a higher wage buys less today than yesterday. Tomorrow may be even worse. Let me read you this letter, illustrating how millions of American wage earners are losing their living standard. In 1941, I was working as a railroad telegrapher, as I am today. My weekly wage was $38.88, subtracting $1.17 for railroad retirement. I had $37.71 take-home pay, no income tax. My weekly wage now is $71.32, but from that comes $4.46 retirement and $10.50 income tax. Net, $56.36. Also, the cost of living has gone up 189% in the meantime. My old take-home pay was equivalent to $71.27 today. But my take-home pay today actually is that $56.36. My loss in income is $14.91. In other words, after 11 years and with no compensation for added experience or increased productivity due to technological developments, I have actually suffered a pay cut of about $15 per week. And so it is with all of us. In this march away from our traditional American standards, few of our former liberties have been left unimpaired. Rights and powers specifically reserved to state, community, and individual by constitutional mandate have been ruthlessly suppressed
by creeping federal authority. Reckless abuse has been made of that most dangerous of all sovereign powers, the power to tax. We find ourselves already past the point where higher taxes might be expected to produce higher revenue. The propaganda of fear is replacing our once dynamic initiative, well-tested vision, and unparalleled energy in a frantic effort to whiplash the country into a maximum of production. This misdirection of public policy, which so endangers survival of our traditional American way of life, finds its genesis in an alien and foreign philosophy, its application in American politics designed to further entrench a 20-year hold upon the political power. It emphasizes with startling clarity the sage warning of a wise and far-seeing Democratic leader of many years ago, Senator Benjamin Hill of the state of Georgia, who foresaw something of what has happened, but I dare say expected the responsibility would be chargeable to a Republican administration. He cautioned on the floor of the Senate of the United States, "I have said I do not dread industrial corporations as instruments of power to destroy this country, because there are 1,000 agencies which can regulate, restrain, and control them. But there is a corporation we may all well dread. That corporation is the federal government. From the aggressions of this corporation, there can be no safety if it is allowed to go beyond the well-defined limits of its power. I dread nothing so much as the exercise of ungranted and doubtful powers by this government. It is, in my opinion, the danger of dangers to the future of this country. Let us be sure to keep it always within its limits. If this great, ambitious, ever-growing corporation become oppressive, who shall check it? If it become wayward, who shall control it? If it become unjust, who shall trust it? As sentinels on the country's watchtower, senators, I beseech you, watch and guard with sleepless dread that corporation which can make all property and rights, all states and people, and all liberty and hope its playthings in an hour and its victims forever." How prophetic this warning. How far our institutions have been yielded to these very excesses of power which he so deeply feared. And this, ironically enough, under the stewardship of his own party. Let none say this is but a partisan conclusion, for north or south, east or west, men and women of whatever political faith recognize the tragic truth of this circumstance. But our failures in domestic policy can be overcome, for government takes its tone, its character, even its general efficiency from its leadership. Sound leadership can restore integrity to the public service, can economize in the public administration, can eliminate disloyal elements from public authority, can purge our educational system of subversive and immoral influence, can restore to youth its rightful heritage, can strengthen the fabric of our free economy, can raise the dollar to its true value, can reduce the tax burden on individual and industry, can regain the course of constitutional direction, can recapture personal liberties now impaired, can correct social inequities, can strengthen the position of both worker and owner in private industry even while protecting the public interest, can fortify the initiative, energy, and enterprise of the farmer so as to ensure the adequacy of the production of food in lean years and its distribution in those of plenty without being crippled by the unwarranted interference and domination of government, and can rearm the nation without undue burden upon the people. The correction of domestic evils and lapses would not be too difficult, provided the will to do so firmly exists. Foreign policy has been as tragically an error as has domestic policy. We practically invited Soviet dominance over the free peoples of Eastern Europe through strategic dispositions of Soviet force at the close of the European War. We deliberately withdrew our armies from thousands of square miles of hard-won territory, permitting the advance of Soviet forces to the west to plant the red flag of communism on the ramparts of Berlin, Vienna, and Prague, capitals of Western civilization. We recklessly yielded effective control over areas of vast uranium deposits without which the Soviet might never have developed the threat of atomic power.